Over 100 years ago, Boar's Head opened its doors with a different set of rules. No cutting corners, no compromises. Exceptional Boar's Head products began to appear. Our deluxe ham, oven gold turkey, and ever roast chicken. Made to standards rarely found in the deli business today. Of course, Boar's Head isn't sold everywhere. Only in stores that share our high standards and slice our products fresh at the deli. Boar's Head. Compromise elsewhere.
Welcome to the fifth episode of the Hope Illuminated Podcast, your source for the stories, science, and strategies of suicide prevention and mental health promotion, where we live, learn, and work. I am your host, Dr. Sally Spencer-Thomas, and I am on a life mission to empower communities with solutions that help people overcome isolation and despair and rekindle a passion for living. Each episode, we're joined by international experts who inspire hope and offer real guidance. Welcome to the show. I am so glad you are here. Well, it's National Suicide Prevention Week, and this podcast is going to be focused on strategy. And the reason I chose this point of focus is because many people are paying attention to the issue of suicide prevention around the nation and around the world during this time. And most people are really focusing on raising awareness. And while I think that is a very viable endeavor, I also have always said that raising awareness is a necessary but insufficient strategy for changing culture, and that we need far more comprehensive and sustained efforts to really achieve the goals that we're hoping to achieve. Sometimes awareness raising is like the state trooper effect, where we're just paying attention to something that's brought to our attention, but as soon as it's in our rearview mirror, we forget all about it. So today we're going to really be talking about how to make something sticky with strategy. And one of the ways I like to frame it is really around a parable that we often use in the work of public health, and we call it the upstream, midstream, and downstream understanding. And it goes something like this. Imagine, if you will, you know, it's a beautiful summer day. You're out walking by a lovely river. The birds are chirping. The sun is shining. And you look down in the river and you notice, oh, my goodness, there's somebody drowning in this river. So you don't waste a second. You jump into the river and you pull out this person who's drowning. You perform CPR. They gurgle and spurt and they come back to life and you feel amazing. You just saved someone's life. And so not a second later, you look back over into the river and now there are two more people drowning in the river. Well, now you're overwhelmed. You can't save both of them. So you start hollering out, hey, everybody, jump into the river with me. We've got people drowning in here. Now it's a little bit of a chaotic scene. People are thrashing around. Everybody's feeling burnt out and overwhelmed. A couple people might try to swim upstream a little bit and teach people to tread water, but often it's a little too late. And the drowning people keep coming, and many of them are missed. In your exasperation, you throw up your hands. You jump on the side of the bank of the river, and you start charging upstream. And everyone back in the river says, oh, my gosh, where are you going? We have people drowning in the river. And you say, I'm going upstream to figure out who's pushing all these people in. And that's really what a larger strategy looks like. Obviously, we cannot ignore the people drowning in the river. And that's really what our invited guest today is going to be talking about, is how do we do a better job responding to the crisis of suicide. But we also need to look beyond the crisis and look at some midstream and upstream ideas to prevent the crisis from happening in the first place. That would be upstream. Or midstream, how do we identify people with the emerging issues as early as possible in that progression and do a very good job of linking them to care that's going to stop that progression to save their life. And so that's what I get excited about, is really looking at the full spectrum of how we can respond and prevent these types of tragedies. The other thing that is really important that I've thought a lot about is that we really need to focus on strategy on multiple dimensions. So grassroots strategy is super important. We need to be listening to the people most directly affected by our policies, by our interventions, by our treatments, all of that. We need to be listening on what's working and what's not working, where the gaps are, and what possibly are the solutions. And we also need to be engaging grass tops or leadership. So grassroots and grass tops together in a very coordinated fashion where each are listening intently to the opportunities and challenges that are being presented and really getting them to appreciate the fact that a multiple point strategy from multiple types of stakeholders is really important for successful implementation. And then as I alluded to in the opening comments, the strategy really needs to be sustained and comprehensive. A one-time assembly, a one-time awareness walk, a one-time anything, a one-time training really won't have the stickiness that we need to change culture, that we really need to, as David often says, and I'm sure he'll go on to explain it, we need to bake it in, not bolt it on. We need to weave in these strategies into the fabric of the culture of the community, of the system, of the organization that we're trying to influence. So that's kind of where we're headed a little bit today, and I'm super excited now to introduce one of my closest friends, one of my dearest co-workers and commiserators and conspirators, David Covington. And I was reflecting back as I was thinking about my opening remarks here about when I first encountered this incredible human. And it was actually during the time when we were getting the National Action Alliance just up and running. The National Action Alliance for Suicide Prevention is a public-private partnership at the top levels of the United States, really designed to implement the national strategy. And in 2009, 2010, we started putting together ideas of who we wanted to serve on the executive committee. And we started getting these applications and letters of recommendations from this man named David Covington. And I remember going, my goodness, not only is he super impressive, he's incredibly ambitious. I think we got, 40, maybe 50 letters of recommendation. And so we absolutely couldn't say no. And as soon as I got to meet him, I was so impressed. And we have a lot of common friends and common interests, and so we've just been fast friends over the years. We've traveled around the world together, I guess I would say stirring the pot a little bit, challenging people's thinking around kind of traditional ideas that people have about what could work for suicide prevention. And we've been to Estonia and Tokyo, most recently Malaysia and Beijing, and it's just been a lot of fun to be a partner with David in this effort. Today, we serve on multiple committees together. He's currently the CEO of RI International. He's the co-lead of the Action Alliance Zero Suicide Advisory Group, and he's president-elect of the American Association of Suicidology and co-chair of the steering committee for the National Suicide Prevention Lifeline. So he is leading in many places and in many spaces. And what really inspires me a lot and impresses me most about David is that he's such a visionary. He really challenges our thinking. And I'll just give you a couple of examples. His blog, Is Suicide Really a Choice?, really got a lot of us to think that through. And he shares very powerful stories about really shifting our thinking from, is this truly free will, or is it more of a succumbing to overwhelming pain? He has written a number of breakthrough white papers, and the one that we'll probably be talking about most today is a white paper called Crisis Happens Now, and I'll let him share a little bit more of that. He is also a strategist that brings together influencers in a way to make big things happen, and I am so happy to be part of that initiative with him. He's put on 3 international zero suicide summits, and I was able to attend the most recent one in Sydney, Australia. And really, honestly, there's nothing more inspiring than being sitting in a room of thought leaders internationally who are really digging into and working on the aspirational goal of making zero suicide happen. So such an exciting thing. And then the final thing that impresses me so much about David is he is an amazing communicator. He has a way of taking very complicated concepts and making them very compelling to very different audiences. And so without further ado, it is my utmost pleasure and honor to introduce my friend and coworker and colleague, David Covington. Welcome, David.
Oh, thank you so much, Sally. And I've loved working with you, the Action Alliance for Suicide Prevention, where we both first worked together, has just been a, to me, breakthrough effort as the U.S. has prioritized suicide prevention and crisis intervention in a way that we had never seen before. And the opportunity to be a part of that group with you and to work around the world has been terrific. You asked for me to start out a little bit with my story.
Yes, if you would please. What is your life path that has brought you to this moment? What fuels your passion for this?
Yeah. So it's been a little more than 20 years ago now, and you mentioned you and I traveling all over the world. In the mid-90s, I was traveling all over middle Georgia. and I was I'm a licensed professional counselor. I got my master's in community agency counseling from the University of Memphis and began working for a nonprofit community mental health center, Highland Rivers, in the area just northwest of Atlanta. And this was back when crisis workers carried a pager. And, you know, I worked community mental health during the day. I was a therapist working with people with serious mental illness. I worked with kids. I did groups, just the full sort of gamut. And then at night, you would carry that pager. And there were certainly nights that it didn't go off. And there were nights that, you know, I'd have dinner and then I would get in the car and drive to Cartersville, Georgia, about 45 minutes away and meet with someone. Or then I would get home and get in the bed, and then the pager would go off and drive to Dallas, Georgia. So I you know, it was one of those things where you could be up throughout the night engaging people who were at risk and who had come into contact with public safety or had walked into the emergency department or the family member had brought them. And they were now needing a psychiatric assessment and engagement and intervention. And at that time, I was doing, you know, hundreds of these evaluations and engagements. And we had a basic sort of toolkit, some methodologies that had come in from Beck, and some basic training from the community of mental health. But I wasn't aware of this larger crisis industry of individuals around the country who were working together, and in fact, I don't know that they were aware of each other that much either at that point in time. You had crisis call centers around the country, probably somewhere between 150 and 200 of those organizations, and you had community mental health centers throughout the country, probably 2,500 or so, who were doing work similar to what I was doing. But there really wasn't much at that time of a professional orientation or a network of support or research or professional standards or practices that we could look to. And I was going out and doing that work and running into all kinds of situations. Just to tell a couple of stories of things that sort of emblazoned in my memory. I remember one night I drove to Redmond Hospital, and there was a young woman who had come in who had taken some pills in a suicide attempt. And I had to drive 45 minutes to get to her to do a psychiatric assessment. And before I got there had been some brief interface with her, but no questions about her pain or anguish or what was leading to her taking that particular attempt. That was my job. That's what I would do. And after I had provided an evaluation with her and had a dialogue, then I would go to the physician and make recommendations, and it would ultimately be he or she that would make decisions about next steps. So as I walked in, I overheard the physician talking to the charge nurse, and he was explaining that he had ordered a charcoal lavage, a procedure to, you know, to ensure that any poison that was in the person's stomach could be extracted and minimize the danger to them is certainly the goal of that. But what he said was that he was going to order that procedure despite the fact that it wasn't medically necessary. In other words, there was she didn't require that, but he was going to do that, and he used these exact words to teach her a lesson. About wasting the time of the staff there in the emergency department who were there to work with car accidents and gunshot wounds and other medical things. So he had made an assessment of the nature of her psychological situation based upon just some very few factors, her age, her gender, and what she had done.
Heartbreaking.
And without really understanding the significance of her psychiatric distress or pain or trauma or anything that had gone on, because none of those questions had even been asked. So I also ran into situations where I saw the impact of individuals who had gone into psychiatric inpatient care. I was working closely with one young man who I had worked with a psychiatrist and made an order for him to be involuntarily committed because we were very concerned about his safety. And it all made perfect sense to me until the point in time that I am engaging the transportation and law enforcement arrives and sort of takes the situation out of my hands. They see a young African-American male who was as tall as I was. He was probably 15 or 16 at that time, but much taller than you would expect for that age. And law enforcement shackled his hands behind his back and then shackled his feet to put him in the back of the car. And I would learn later that that wasn't the most traumatic thing that occurred to him during the course of that hospitalization. So I had these experiences as a clinician and working with individuals that gave me a real appreciation for people are aware of the challenges of mental health systems and crisis services. They're aware that certain decisions may be taken outside of their control. They're aware of the maze and challenges of getting through, and yet they still pick up the phone. And why do they do that? They don't do that naively. They do it because they are at their wit's end or a family member just doesn't know what else to do. I've sort of called it the 400-pound phone in times past, that people, they don't want to pick that phone up. They want to use their own skills, their own supports, their own resilience. They want to rely on their friends. They want to do all those things. So they don't pick up that phone until all of those things have just failed, and they just can't see through any other way. So they do so warily. They do so carefully. But when they do it, they do run into some very significant challenges that I got to experience firsthand and was a part of. As I went along in my career, I landed up working with not only the crisis teams of community mental health, but in 2002 joined a company that provided crisis services as its core business. It was a crisis call center, and it also engaged mobile crisis staff who were not just meeting people at an emergency department or a hospital, but are going out to where the person is in crisis. They're going to their home. They're going to the street. If it's a homeless individual or an apartment, they might be going to a social service agency or a jail or a school. And it was the first time I began to understand more about this these crisis services and some of the inherent challenges that systemically we have in place in the U.S. We're now just a year or so away from 60 years of a crisis services industry. Dee Dee Hirsch and Ed Schneiderman in 1958 opened the first what we would call suicide hotline, and leading into crisis psychiatric crisis call center in Atlanta, where I was. That center opened in 1966, and up until the early 2000s, it looked pretty much the same. It was co-located with the 911, and you had some clinical staff and other individuals who were answering phones, and they were taking a few notes, but their main effort was trying to understand what was going on and then engage and connect individuals to services despite some of those challenges that we've talked about. But what I would learn during the course of that time is that these services are really engaging people that are at significant risk, despite a constant sort of pressure among medical and behavioral health professionals that minimize some of that, and also frustration about that. Going back to that young woman with the overdose, that they aren't equipped, or they're not trained, or it's not their primary job. So all of that sort of comes together. But during that sort of, as I began to work in a crisis services agency and attend conferences where some of those agencies were beginning to come together, in 2003 I attended the American Association of Suicidology conference in Santa Fe and began to meet other leaders who were working with similar agencies across the country. So I met the folks from Behavioral Health Response in St. Louis and found a crisis call center that was using technology in a way that hadn't been done before, and bringing a professional approach to crisis intervention that was unique. And they also were partnering with a number of community mental health organizations, and were not an exact sort of outreach of one center, but a partnership of multiple centers. Then met the leaders from Harris Center in Houston, Texas, who had a full continuum of crisis services, including a psychiatric emergency department. And through that sort of time, began to see some of the innovations going on around the country. And then in the early 2000s, had the opportunity to work with the National Suicide Prevention Lifeline as they began to really put a professional orientation to the field, to bring people together around common standards, around technology, around research, and begin to sort of address some of these sort of inherent challenges. And it was the first time I began to really get a sense of the dilemma. So we are, as a nation, encouraging individuals who are suicidal or having a mental health crisis or an addiction challenge that's beyond them to outreach 911 or a hospital emergency department, or even better yet, to contact crisis services, psychiatric crisis services directly. But what we then see are a number of challenges. We see that frequently people are going into hospitals and they're in a crisis and they need to go to the hospital emergency department first before they get to the service that they need. And when we are, for those of us who haven't had a mental health emergency but have been into a hospital for other reasons, sprained wrist or a more serious medical condition, we are traumatized almost by waits that are in the hours. If you ask your peers about experience, they'll certainly talk about long waits being in the 3-4 to 7 hour sort of range, when what we find is people with mental health issues are waiting in emergency departments for literally for days.
Yeah.
In Washington State, a Seattle Times review found that in 2013, the average wait was about 3 days. So we found some really embedded challenges and opportunities to better meet people's needs when they're in crisis through those crisis services. And that's become a real sort of passion for me, an area that that fuels the work that I do.
Thank you very much for that incredible journey with you. And
I'll just share a little bit too of kind of my observation around this shift through an experience I had with one of your centers. So how this usually plays out with folks, even backs up before the emergency room, right? So somebody's worried about someone who is expressing suicide thoughts and behavior in a home, probably, and a loved one calls 911, and then the next thing that happens is, you know, lights and sirens and first responders are descending in your neighborhood, and your neighbors are all geeking out their windows, you know, what's going down at the Johnson house. Then often you're kind of like the young man that you spoke of, you're cuffed or shackled and ushered into the back seat of a cruiser if you're not in any kind of medical situation, brought into the emergency room where the experience is very often other quote-unquote higher-level emergencies are ushered in front of you, which just increases the sense of worthlessness and, you know, nobody cares, I'm not important sense. And then if you do get back, you know, your quote-unquote treatment initially is to be, you know, stripped of all your worldly belongings, put in a very flimsy gown, and sometimes handcuffed to the gurney, sometimes being monitored by a total stranger, often a security guard for the hospital. There is nothing about that that is at all dignified or gives any kind of comfort. Now, let me contrast that with my experience going to one of your centers in Phoenix a couple of years ago, where I got walked through the process as if I was a patient being admitted. And the interface between the law enforcement and being welcomed into the center was just a three-minute overview, some paperwork being filled out. I was patted down for potential weapons. And then I was brought into the emergency room. And rather than sitting on some hard, cold chairs for hours and hours, I was greeted by a very welcoming person, brought to a recliner, offered a blanket and a glass of water. The next thing that happened was a beautiful animal-assisted therapy dog came around. Everything about that was about bringing down agitation, making people feel comfortable and welcomed, and that was a far more pleasant experience. I'm sure you'll have more to say about that, but I wanted to share that story, and I'm so glad that you let me have that experience.
Well, I'm so glad that you got that opportunity, Sally. The focus of that particular program, which is now 25 years old out there in Peoria, Arizona, in that living room, is it's a crisis stabilization center. It's a program that's designed as an alternative to psychiatric inpatient. And it's there in many reasons from the managed care organization and Arizona Medicaid as a much less costly alternative to psychiatric inpatient, shorter stays and less costly without the overhead of a large hospital system. However, as you described it, it also provides an opportunity for an individual to be in much more of less of an institutional environment. More, we call it the living room. We don't refer to individuals as patients. They're guests while they're there. We use a retreat mentality. And we don't have the plexiglass fishbowl that you see in some crisis programs where staff are separated from the guests that are there. It's about the creating the best healing and welcoming space that we can, and focusing on that. So it's much more dignified. It's a lot less costly, and what's more, we see that it's more effective. It just simply works better. But the other piece about that is, if we go back to that young man that you talked about, the common practice, there are a lot of those kinds of facilities around the country, hundreds of them actually. And the common practice is when a family member or an individual on their own or neighbor contacts law enforcement and they land up interfacing with that individual, is that they will say, the law enforcement officer will say, okay, I'm going to take them to that crisis center. And then as they get to if they actually go to the crisis center will say to them, oh, no, you've made a mistake. You don't bring them here first. You need to take them to the hospital first. And the reason, it sort of makes sense as you think about it, it seems to, you need to take them there to make sure they don't have a medical problem that we can't serve here at this crisis center. But what actually happens is when they get to that hospital, they are there for hours and hours or even days for quote-unquote medical clearance before they come back, if they come back, to a crisis center. So there's a lot of not only intrusiveness but a burden that we are placing on an individual who picked up that 400-pound phone, or someone else did. And the cost that's associated with that runaround that occurs. So in that Peoria facility, we have 300 times a month that a law enforcement officer is driving into a they don't call us, they don't make a referral, they don't put something into an app, they just drive to us. And the reality there is we want them to come to us, and we want to make it as easy as possible. If we don't do that, frequently they don't take the person to the hospital because that takes too much time. They will file some kind of nuisance crime and put them in jail. Mm-hmm. They also sometimes relocate them or drop them off somewhere else. They're doing something to they have a job. It's similar to the emergency department. They're focused on public safety, and they see this as not their core mission. So we've got to make it as easy and supportive as possible for them, where there's a car, yep, a parking space for them, a special door. They walk in. We do a warm transfer. We get any information we have, and they're back on the street. So what we're really trying to do with that program is we want it to be dignified, respectful, and a gracious and gentle engagement of an individual that's in pain. But we also want to do that in a way that works for our hospital partners, our law enforcement partners, and is less costly for the funder. And that's really where I think we've got opportunity to create something different in the U.S. around crisis.
Thank you. It's quite a compelling vision, and I think everybody resonates around what we currently have. Is it working very well? And so to have an idea of what could be far more effective is extremely exciting. I'm going to pivot now and have you talk a little bit about some of the research, some of the science that informs this vision and your approach to thinking about crisis. How do you know what works? How do we know which places to plug into? And what's in the future for some research that we're hoping to learn more about soon?
Well, let me talk a little bit about, if I might, Sally, about research and also about experience. I'm not a researcher. I'm a healthcare leader, and for 5 years I was the clinical lead, responsible for the program, financial performance, and the outcomes of a $750 million a year managed care system. So, we certainly were interested in the research, but we're also trying to on a daily basis deploy programming that is safe, that's cost effective, and that it works. Now, the research is, if we look back at the crisis center industry over the course of the last 15 years in particular, we had a time when I described those crisis centers across the country in the late 90s and early 2000s that didn't really know each other that well, didn't operate off of standard practices and procedures or research. The common sort of idea, even among suicide prevention advocates, was that those centers, those crisis call centers, were a waste of investment. The belief was that people in real crisis didn't call those centers, and that middle-aged individuals, little old ladies with dysthymia, who were lonely, would call into those centers. These were the myths that were sort of out there and pervasive, that these centers just weren't effective and didn't reach people in need. And in the 2003, 4, and 5 range, research out of Columbia University, Rutgers, and University of Montreal, Brian Mashara, John Califat, and Maddie Gould began to, for the first time, do material work on the outcomes of crisis engagement. In separate studies, those three researchers were listening in silently to thousands of phone calls across a variety of, I think it was as many as 16 or 20 different crisis centers around the country. And they were simply monitoring the level of distress that occurred at the beginning of those calls, doing a second engagement of what happened over the course of that call and changed or not, and then obtaining consent to follow up 2 weeks later, because ostensibly the crisis engagement would have made some kind of referral to some service, an outpatient service or crisis, maybe like that facility in Peoria we talked about, and the person would be better 2 weeks later. In fact, there was a little bit of slant at that time around an information and referral approach that the primary work of those crisis call agents was to get a service to the individual, and that's what would make the difference. But we didn't know a lot at that point. We didn't really know the level of distress that people were in, and we didn't know what change would occur. And in that groundbreaking work, Madeline Gould used the profile of mood states to develop a composite anguish score, if you will, or level of distress of that caller, and we found that the distress level was far beyond even what those of us who were in the industry thought once we began to have real data about it, that not only were very suicidal people and individuals in extraordinary distress contacting those lines, but we began to have the data for the number of times that an individual was actually in the process of a suicide attempt. They were sitting in the bathtub where they'd already cut themselves or they'd already taken a poison or they'd already done something. We began to have real data about that. And one of the things that struck us most was, what, first, the level of distress at baseline of the individuals contacting these services, and second, the level of decline that occurred even within the phone call. In fact, there was a slightly greater reduction in distress that occurred over the course of the brief call engagement as opposed to what happened 2 weeks later. And that data began to inform us. Now, over the last, since 2005, when John Draper and the National Suicide Prevention Lifeline began to really take this stepwise forward in partnership with Richard McKeon and James Wright from SAMHSA, we've seen multiple iterations of that research. And in the last few years, Maddie Gould has begun to really focus in on that follow-up component. And changing the focus of the field to look at the follow-up itself and the crisis center doing follow-up, not just that we do this in context of a research study, but we make it a natural mode of our engagement. The sort of prior approach was a crisis center said, we have so many people coming in the front door, we just don't have the time to follow up with anybody after we've concluded the call. But once they did that, what they found was that the assessment of satisfaction and the experience of the caller has been, if I'm a call center agent and I get a call from someone and I'm empathic and I'm collaborative and I'm engaging, the person on the other end says, okay, that was helpful. I'm going to give it a C+ or a B-. And part of that is because the perception of that caller is, well, that person's just doing their job. They get paid to help me, and they look around at the way society treats people with mental health issues, put it in that filter, and that it comes out sort of as a, okay, that was helpful, but, you know, they're just doing their job. If I call them up 48 hours later and say, hey, I'm just checking up on you because we talked the day before yesterday, and here's the service we connected you to, and I want to see how you're doing. And I do the same exact thing I did the first time. I'm engaging. I'm respectful. I'm collaborative. I show some care. No difference than I did the other time. The person's perception of it is phenomenally different. It's like A+ mm-hmm. now. And it's mm-hmm. a simple pivot of, they didn't contact me, I contacted them. Now I'm still getting paid to make that call, but their perception mm-hmm. of it changes. So all of this research is really beginning to shift our sort of thinking about how this works. But at the same time that research is going on, I also want to talk briefly about the cost effectiveness and rapid cycle performance improvement. We did a national webinar in partnership with NASHBID, the National Association of State Mental Health Program Directors, yesterday. And on that call, I co-led that call with Tom Betlach. Tom is the director of Arizona Medicaid, the $12 billion healthcare system. And in Arizona, the mental health system has merged with the primary care system. And so now the effective commissioner of mental health, if you will, is also the director of the entire Medicaid system, Tom Betlach. And we have, over the last 25 years, seen iteration after iteration of managed care organizations that are working for Arizona Medicaid to deliver care. And every year, they're focused on not only what does the research tell them, but they've got a scope of responsibility and contracts around the deployment of their resources to meet the needs of individuals according to medical necessity and a provider manual of key services. but they are having to provide care that's safe and effective and less costly. And what has happened over multiple iterations of that has been three primary things. One is that the sort of this isn't a innovation anymore in Arizona. It's a bottom line expectation that an individual in crisis that interfaces with law enforcement, that officer is taking them directly to the crisis center. We know that works better for the person. We know it's extremely less costly. It's faster access. It's just it's a better solution all the way around. But we've also seen that similar approach with other crisis services, community-based mobile crisis. Again, commonplace practice in the U.S. is for mobile crisis to engage with somebody at risk and say, hey, go. Why don't you drive over to the local hospital and I'll meet you there. The benefit of going directly to the street corner where that person is, to the apartment, to the home, to the social service agency. Again, we're stripping out time of getting to their needs. We're lessening the chance of those intrusive impacts that you talked about, Sally, of being shackled and put in the back of a law enforcement car, of having procedures done at a hospital that are unnecessary. And then the other thing that we've seen is the emergence of crisis call centers that look far different than that one that I saw that started in 1966 in Atlanta, but rather high-tech centers where it's caring and professional staff, but they're using a host of Uber-like technology tools to schedule people into appointments directly, not giving them referrals that they need to follow up with later, using GPS technology to dispatch the closest available mobile crisis, using electronic bed boards that give an immediate view of what's available through the system and how to get the person to it faster. So I think we've got research driving change in crisis services, but we also have rapid cycle, robust performance improvement that is really just doing some common sense sort of things that, even though they make so much sense, are still not the practice around the country. I think mm-hmm. what I see more frequently in crisis services is caring individuals, caring staff, who the person before them, they're giving the love and attention, engagement, and collaboration that they know. But the moment that person steps aside, and what we do is we take a post-it note and write their name on it. And then we make a call and we leave a voicemail. And by the time you do that for a little bit, you have a set of post-it notes on your desk. I was sitting with a dear friend of mine one time, and she had 30 or 40 of these blue post-it notes on her desk. And that was a bad day. She was a little frustrated. And at one point, she began to take them and just toss them in the air. And it was like the snow of post-it mm-hmm. notes floating all over the place. And that's where the orchestration of these vital safety net services has been, that we have left to voicemail, to post-it notes, and we're talking about people who you know, going back to that suicide as a choice that you started with, that people are hanging on. So we're seeing the deployment of much more professional and thoughtful approaches that are integrating science, research, and beginning to look at cost and effectiveness and how quickly can we meet people's needs, and measuring does it work in a way that we just simply haven't approached in times past.
Wonderful. And I know there's another key element of the new way of envisioning crisis services that is getting some traction and is near and dear to my heart, and that is the involvement of people with lived experience, both as kind of collaborators in creating this, but also as care deliverers within the crisis system through peer support. And I'm wondering if you could just speak a little bit about that, and also any research you're aware of that supports that.
Yeah, so, you know, the 90s was, I think, the 30th anniversary of psychiatric rehabilitation. It was supposed to be the year of recovery. And yet, by the end of the 90s, you had almost no penetration of peer supports and psychiatric rehabilitation concepts of it's not what's wrong, but what's strong about a person. That makes sense. You saw almost no penetration into the mainstream mental health system in the U.S. But over the course of the last 17 years since that time, we've started to see real movement. So psychiatric rehabilitation tells us that phase one is we do things to people. people. And if we think about the old asylum system, that was certainly the sort of culture of medicating and forcing things. Much of the original work of the community mental health era has been doing things for people. Much better than doing things to them, but still a level of caretaking and creating a dependency that did not yield the kind of outcomes that we were looking for. And psychiatric rehabilitation says we do things with people. It's that engagement and collaboration that research from Brian Mashara has showed is what works, is what is effective. But what we've sort of begun thinking about at RI over the course of the last several years is there are two levels beyond doing things with people. Yes, we always want to engage and collaborate, but if it's professionals, if it's social workers, counselors like myself, psychiatrists and nurses that are doing things with people, and no individuals with lived experience or lived expertise in the mix, it's not as effective as beginning to have, let's go to the next level up, that we've engaged peers in that process. When I moved to Phoenix in 2009, each of our large clinics serving people with serious mental illness had a peer mentor and a family mentor. But a single one, a token one, we had our first step. And so that token peer engagement is, I think, a level above doing things with people. But the highest level, level five, if you want to call it that, is where we've got a tangible, material representation of peers in that mix. And it creates something different. At the end of the recession, I was at a managed care organization, and we had about $40 million restored from the legislature and the governor as the economy came up from cuts that had previously been made. And one of the things we did was dramatically expand the peer connection to the mainstream services. All of them had some token participation, but we took that to an entirely new level. Now, we had peer-run organizations. We dramatically enhanced those programs. But those programs, as powerful as they were, touched a fraction of the individuals in the system. And it was the mainstream services that really needed a different approach. So we brought in peer mentors, peer coaches, peer supports, crisis navigators, individuals who were in peer roles to engage in clinical teams in ways that we hadn't seen before. Now, RI, we've been doing that here for many, many years. So we've got about 1,000 staff in our 50 programs, and half of them are individuals with lived experience. They're people with serious mental illness living a life of recovery who've been through our certified peer program. But let's just think about what a difference that makes when you come into a program where 25, 30, even 50% or more of the staff are individuals who are peers. At that Peoria program you referenced, it's a crisis stabilization program. By licensure, it meets those criteria. It has psychiatrists and nurse practitioner staff who are supporting that, and clinicians. And it has an area that when a law enforcement officer brings someone, an area that the psychiatrist will meet with the person before they come into the milieu, just like you would have in any program across the country. But the very first person that individual engages with is a peer. A peer who might themselves have been in the back of that. They might have been shackled in they might have been in that patrol car. And so their first engagement is with someone who is going to talk them through that process and who has been there themselves. But it's not a token piece. Once they get into the program, they're continuing to walk with them through the course of their stay in that program, and they're going to see peers who are part of that who not only have training to equip and engage and support, but who have a life experience that they can share. And it makes a huge difference.
Absolutely. You know, I can just imagine myself going through something like that, or one of my children or whatever. I want them to be treated with that kind of respect and dignity and compassion for the best possible outcome. All right, so now I'm going to ask you about what are the takeaways. As you know, we have a whole variety of different types of audiences that listen to this, some community influencers who may or may not be particularly knowledgeable about mental health systems but have a passion for this cause, parents who are concerned about their teams, mental health leaders. What are some general strategy takeaways that you would offer our audience on how we can all work together to improve our crisis services and our crisis approach?
I think the first step is really identifying where your particular region or state is. So in the webinar yesterday, we shared an assessment of Arizona. We had a video that we showed that showed not only, you mentioned the Peoria facility for RI, but we showed the facilities for Community Bridges, for Connections of Arizona, for La Frontera, for Simpatico, for Crisis Response Network. We had seven organizations in both metropolitan and rural areas who were operating all three of these major fundamental crisis services, of a crisis contact center, of mobile crisis services and facility services, alternatives to psychiatric inpatient. And then we used a framework to assess on a scale of 1 to 5 overall the state of Arizona, and we had a case study behind that. And what we did at the end of the call was we did a poll and asked folks who were involved in the call, and these are state leaders from around the country, to give a score for where their, you know, just their gut level, looking at the framework, where is their system currently. And the lion's share of those were in that 1 to 3.5 range, that they're, mm-hmm. They're just, they're minimally, they have a minimal set of components in place, or just a few tools, but they're not really accessible, or they're only in metropolitan areas and not in rural, et cetera. So what I think where we're encouraging folks is to use that framework at crisisnow.com to establish what do you have. Here's a commonly the way some of these things go. When 10 individuals in Pierce County, just south of Seattle, Washington, sued the state of Washington because they had been waiting so long to get help in emergency departments, the original response of the mental health leadership was that those are just anecdotes. That doesn't happen commonly. That's not the real data, and we shouldn't pay that much attention. And the Seattle Times, as I referenced earlier, they said to themselves, well, let's find out if that's true. And they spent a full year looking at the data. Washington State is a little bit different. They have a certificate of need process around billing for mental health services in the emergency department. So they probably had a level of data that you wouldn't be able to get at in some other states. And after a year, they released their findings that, in fact, the average length of stay for individuals like those suing was 3 days. Not 3 hours, but 3 days. And the outliers they found were weeks. They even found an individual who'd been in for more than a month. And just as you said, Sally, not only did they have the experience of being prioritized down the level and sometimes not treated very well, but they were frequently shackled to a gurney during that process, as the emergency department staff was challenged with having someone who could watch and provide the monitoring and support that was needed. So they found something far different. And the Supreme Court ultimately ruled that it was unconstitutional. Now, right before that ruling, the mental health leadership, once the data was out there, began to say, well, we can't really do anything about it because if we were held to some kind of standard here, homelessness would increase, et cetera, made excuses. But ultimately, the Supreme Court ruled that what they call psychiatric boarding was unconstitutional and had to be changed. And then we began to see real changes occur in Washington State. And actually, Washington State had some really positive resources already in place, but they began to look at it in a much more systematic and strong way. So sometimes it's the first step is really taking that honest look of what the baseline is. John Santapietro led behavioral health at Carolina's Healthcare. Carolina's Healthcare is 900 locations, 40 hospitals, in primarily in North Carolina, but also some in South Carolina. He found when his team was first analyzing this problem that individuals, their average wait in their emergency departments was 40 hours. And they began to take efforts to make a difference, and within a relatively short amount of time, cut that wait in half. So I think the starting point The old saying is models are a dime a dozen, but you have to have one. The Crisis Now model is one framework to begin to do an assessment of where are we? What's our baseline? And beginning to do a hard look at where do we go from here? How do we create a roadmap? Because these systems are built over the course of time. But what gives us the most impact? What's going to be a lot less costly? What's going to be more effective? And what's going to be a lot more humane than what we've done? So that's where we're encouraging people to start, is to take a look and do an assessment of where you're at. Not on for an individual community or city. It's easy to highlight, you know, here in Houston we have this phenomenal program. Let's look at large regions. Let's look at states. What's going on? We've seen a real beginning of a shift in crisis. After years of this being a fragmented sort of patchwork, we're seeing states, some of whom are doing it because of as in Washington State, a Supreme Court ruling, but others like California are focused on the partnership with hospitals and the cost savings that could occur from from a better utilization. Colorado has taken a different approach in looking at public safety and very concerned about a lack of a crisis system being where it needed to be when tragedies like Aurora and Columbine occurred. And then you've got states like Delaware or Georgia who are partnering with governor's offices and consent decrees with the Department of Justice. So we've seen a host of different sort of reasons that people have driven forward, but we are now seeing people are saying this can be done way differently. And we want to start to assess where is your community at?
Excellent. Thank you so much. So obviously leaders in behavioral health and healthcare systems can look at this framework and self-assess in regions. But also, you know, I encourage the general population to take a look at this framework too. We don't have to do business as usual if it's not working. There is another way to go. And everyday citizens can start to advocate in their own communities of how we can improve our crisis services. So I'm going to take a moment here to kind of summarize a little bit of what we've been talking about, to share with folks what I'll highlight in the show notes. And then I'm going to come back to you, David, in a couple of minutes and ask you for some closing thoughts. So here's what I took down in my notes as we were talking. We opened up talking a little bit about kind of general strategy with upstream, midstream, and downstream suicide prevention, and we both mentioned the breakthrough efforts of the National Action Alliance and the Zero Suicide Initiative that are really changing how we're thinking about these things in a very, very broad way. I thought your stories about your early days in Georgia were incredibly powerful, whether it was on one side really minimizing the experience of anguish that people have when they are attempting suicide, and you know, the comment of to teach her a lesson is absolutely heartbreaking, or on the other side, really overreacting from unfounded fears and shackling people. We need to do better than that. I loved your metaphor of the 400-pound phone that, you know, people really do want to depend on their own resilience or their support system, and that people reach out under these circumstances sometimes as a last-ditch effort, and it's really quite cumbersome for them to work through the fears around that or, you know, whatever misgivings or barriers they have. And so when they do, we really need to respond in a way that's going to be most effective. Loved your summary of kind of the 60-year evolution of crisis services and how today we're really looking at some standards and technology that is improving our ability to decrease wait times, increase the dignity and gentle engagement with people in their darkest moments, decrease costs, kind of decrease poor responses or ineffective responses from emergency room care folks or law enforcement. Kind of doing what they're doing, not out of necessarily a place of maliciousness, but just because they don't feel like it's their strength and they want to go back to doing what they're good at. Let's make them feel good about doing this work and make them feel effective by connecting people in the right places. I certainly will refer in the show notes to the Columbia research, Mashara, Caliphate, and Gold's groundbreaking things about really challenging our misperceptions about crisis services, about the level of distress of the caller being very high, is being true, the effectiveness of these calls during the phone call, and then really the magic that we're finding in the follow-up ability. People aren't just, you know, the experiences, people aren't just doing their job, but that they really care, and that sense of care and connection is so healing.
I love the piece. Very important that we are working collaboratively with our science partners, and that this rapid cycle of understanding what's working, leading to robust improvement in care, is exactly where we need to be. We need to be efficient in our research, and it needs to go back to some practical application. So whether that's, you know, how mobile crisis is affecting people, or our high technology of streamlining our referrals and using GPS to locate best coastal services, all of this is really evolving our ability to serve people very quickly. And then obviously our conversation around peer support and crisis service means a lot to me, and I love the description you gave of, you know, from not involving peer support at all or lived experience of doing things to people to kind of this enabling approach of professionals doing things for people. To this tokenism place, to really looking at a place where we are integrating people with lived expertise fully throughout the whole process of planning and implementing services, and that's where we need to head. And then finally, this takeaway that everybody can, you know, have a role in this. Let's look at our own crisis services in our communities. Where can we improve? How can we advocate for that? And really turning to the crisis care framework as a place to assess and then prioritize what our next steps are. So in the show notes, I'll have the Crisis Now paper and framework for people to look through. I will be linking to the Action Alliance and all the resources there. Obviously, all of David's blogs and TED Talks, he's got so much more incredible wisdom to share. I'll also share the links to some of our crisis centers that you highlighted, Dee Dee Hirsch and the Harris Center, and of course the National Suicide Prevention Lifeline. I encourage people to take a look at the American Association of Suicidology and consider being members there, for that's certainly a way to get involved to help change the narrative. And then, David, if you would please also send me whatever videos you're able to share about what crisis centers can look like. I think seeing a video of that is, if you can't get there first person, seeing a video of some of that is really inspirational as a way to conceptualize and get a vision for what's possible. So, David, is there any other place that people can go to find you and some of your work that I haven't mentioned yet? I want to make sure that I've covered everything.
Yeah, so my the key initiatives I've been engaged in, zerosuicide.org, crisisnow.com, and then my innovations in healthcare blog site, davidwcovington.com.
Perfect. All right. Final words from you, and then I'll close up with one last statement. Go ahead.
Yeah, so I've referenced a couple of stories in my past where emergency department staff or law enforcement acted in ways that maybe didn't yield the best results, and that they're following protocols or even frustration came out. But I want to really make sure I focus that our hospital emergency department workers and our law enforcement, our nations, these are heroes that make this country work, and their efforts are extraordinary on a day-to-day basis. We in mental health have looked to them to do our job. And there are
right.
a host of reasons we've done that, but that's what we've done. And it's time for us to stop doing that and to work alongside them as full partners. When I came to Arizona in 2009, I'd spent 15 years in the Georgia system, and I was told about the practice of a law enforcement dropping a person off at a crisis center and driving away. And I simply thought that was not possible, and I certainly didn't believe it was occurring. So I was challenged by a local law enforcement leader to see for myself, and we did an undercover boss kind of night. I wore jeans and a t-shirt. He was in a regular patrol officer uniform, and we were in a regular patrol car. And over the course of a third shift, 10-hour ride, we interfaced with 17 individuals with mental illness and addiction challenges. We picked up one individual who was on a court order, and drove her from the residential housing program she was in, and we went to the urgent care center in downtown. And I knew what would happen anywhere else in the country, that first of all, you can't go directly to the crisis center. You've got to go get a medical clearance first. And secondarily, if you could go to the crisis center first, they would probably hold you for hours while they did an evaluation and decided whether they would take the person, et cetera. We drove up, and short of driving by and opening the door and pushing her out, it could not have been faster. We walked inside. Mm-hmm. We shook hands with the physician leader there. We introduced the woman to the staff. We shared the brief information we had, and they said, hey, thank you very much, and we walked out the door. It was about 5 minutes, and I was my mouth was still sort of dropped as we got into the car, and we had not even sat down when the radio goes off that there is an armed robbery occurring about less than a mile from where we were. So this guy, he's a law enforcement leader, but he's got a job to do. So he immediately throws on the lights. We're blazing away from this crisis center. My heart is pounding. My pulse is beating. We're the second car on the scene. I see individuals. We pull up into the intersection. I jump out, and he's like, you're in the line of fire. Get behind the door. And, you know, at that 2 seconds before that, I would have viewed law enforcement and hospital staff from a history of sort of, you know, mental health martyrdom. But I tell you, the next few moments, it was dusk. I couldn't tell who had a gun, who didn't. I just sort of shot everybody had I had a gun because, you know, the frightening situation that we were in. That was quickly resolved within a minute or two. It was resolved peacefully. The two individuals were taken into custody. And as we looked at each other, we turned around, and right by our car was a Native American man with his lying on the sidewalk with his feet into the street. He was intoxicated, and the law enforcement officer I was with walked over and began to engage and connect with him, talked him into getting in the car with us, and we took him into a Community Bridges detoxification program, a separate program that was nearby, and had the same experience. Within 5 minutes, we had connected the person with services, and we were back on the street. So the reality is law enforcement wants to help, but they want us to do our job. They don't know this area. They don't have training in this area. We've got to make it easy for them, and hospitals want to do the same. And what we found when we begin to do these simple approaches, you can't believe the allies that these partners can be when we simply rise up. And it's not primarily funding that needs to be changed. It's really a difference in culture. It's a difference in strategy, Sally, and it's a difference in perspective. And once you've seen it done, once I saw that it was done, suddenly it was a breakthrough in my own mind that I could do that too. And our programs, we do that across the country now with the same kinds of an approach, that we want law enforcement to come to us, and we're never, ever, ever going to turn a law enforcement away or turn them around. Our answer is always, please, thank you, and please bring us someone else. Because it yields a better result for everyone involved, but especially for that individual who has found themselves either against their own, you know, that they weren't the one who initiated it, or they themselves did finally get to that point that they didn't know what else to do. So the solutions are there, and we're starting to see this cascade. So it's a really exciting time, and I really appreciate, Sally, you taking some time to focus on it today.
Oh, David, I'm so, so glad that you closed with that story. You know that I'm a huge advocate for first responders' work and the incredible part of the survival link of chain that we have here and how much we depend on them. And my point is, just like yours, let's everybody work in our lanes where we're doing the best work with our, you know, skills and our abilities and the role that we play and how do we link those up there most efficiently. Thank you so much. David, this has been quite an inspiring and incredible conversation with you. I'm so grateful that you gave up this hour to share some of your insights and vision with our listeners. And thank you, listeners, for showing up to hear David. And hopefully you'll follow up with some of the suggestions that we've made here. For more episodes of the Hope Illuminated podcast, please go to my website, sallyspencerthomas.com. And you'll find the series of podcasts there. I'm also on iTunes. So if you go to iTunes, please leave me a rating and review. This helps other people find the podcast so we can reach more people. I'm doing a contest here, so I will do some drawings for a $100 gift certificate from Amazon for people who sign up to my newsletter and write a rating and review on iTunes. With the newsletter, you also will learn about upcoming Twitter chats and blogs that are being posted and so forth. And I hope all of that is helpful and rich content as you need. So please give me information about what's working for you. So in closing, I will share my motto: open your heart, challenge your thinking, take action to save lives. Together we can restore dignity and sustain a passion for living. Thank you.
Hi, this is Maury Moreland Morrison, here to tell you GEICO has more than just great savings. Much more. Yes, while GEICO could help you rack up more moolah faster than you can say metamorphosis, they've also been the fastest growing auto insurer for more than 10 years. That's more like it. Furthermore, GEICO has fast and friendly claim service. That might seem like an oxymoron, but it's not. All the more reason to say no other auto insurer has more than GEICO. GEICO, expect great savings and a whole lot more.